and pondered my crossword puzzle and where I might be going wrong. For some weeks I had been trying to compose one that was good enough to be sent to a newspaper to be considered for publication, but I wasn't having much success. After we had looked at all three rooms, Poirot insisted that we return to the one on the second floor, Richard Negus's, number 238. Would I find it any easier to enter these rooms, I wondered, the more I did it? So far the answer was no. Walking once again into Negus's hotel room felt like forcing my heart to climb the most perilous mountain, in the certain knowledge that it will be left stranded as soon as it reaches the top. Poirot, unaware of my distress, which I concealed effectively, I hope, stood in the middle of the room and said, "Bon, this is the one that is most different from the others, n'est-ce pas? Ida Gransberry has the tray and the additional teacup in her room, it is true, but here there is the sherry glass instead of the teacup. And here we have one window open to its full capacity, while in the other two rooms all the windows are closed. Mr. Negus's room is intolerably cold." "This is how it was when Monsieur Lazari walked in and found Negus dead," I said. "Nothing's been altered in any way." Poirot walked open to the open window. "Here is Monsieur Lazari's wonderful view that he offered to show me of the hotel's gardens. Both Harriet Sipple and Ida Gransberry had rooms on the other side of the hotel with views of the splendid London. Do you see those trees, Catchpool?" I told him that I did, wondering if he had me down as a colossal idiot. How could I fail to see trees that were directly outside the window? "Another difference here is the position of the cufflink," said Poirot. "Did you notice that? In Harriet Sipple's and Ida Gransberry's mouths, the cufflink is slightly protruding between the lips, whereas Richard Negus has the cufflink much further back, almost at the entrance to the throat." I opened my mouth to object, then changed my mind, but it was too late. Poirot had seen the argument in my eyes. "What is it?" he asked. "I think you're being a touch pedantic," I said. "All three victims have monogrammed cufflinks in their mouths, and the same initials on each one, P.I.J. That's something they have in common. It isn't a difference, no matter which of their teeth the cufflink happens to be next to." "But it is a very big difference. The lips, the entrance to the throat, these are not the same place, not at all." Poirot walked over so that he was standing right in front of me. "Catchpool, please, remember what I am about to tell you. When three murders are almost identical, the smallest divergent details are of the utmost importance." Was I supposed to remember these wise words even if I disagreed with them? Poirot needn't have worried. I remember nearly every word he has spoken in my presence. And the ones that infuriated me most are the ones I remember best of all. "All three cufflinks were in the mouths of the victims," I repeated with determined obstinacy. "That's good enough for me." "This I see," said Poirot, with an air of dejection. "Good enough for you, and good enough also for your 100 people that you might ask, and also, I have no doubt, for your bosses at Scotland Yard. But not good enough for Hercule Poirot." I had to remind myself that he was talking about definitions of similarity and difference, and not about me personally. "What about the open window, when all the windows in the other two rooms are closed?" he asked. "Is that a difference worth noting?" "It's unlikely to be relevant," I said. "Richard Negus might have opened the window himself. There would be no reason for the murderer to close it. You've said it often yourself, Poirot. We Englishmen open windows in the dead of winter because we believe it's good for our character." "Mon ami," said Poirot patiently, "consider. These three people did not drink poison, fall out of their armchairs, and quite naturally land flat on their backs with their arms at their sides and their feet pointing towards the door. It is impossible. Why would one not stagger across the room? Why would one not fall out of the chair on the other side? The killer. He arranged the bodies so that each one was in the same position at an equal distance from the chair and from the little table. Eh bien, if he cares so much to arrange his three murder scenes to look exactly the same, why does he not wish to close the window that, yes, perhaps Mr. Richard Negus has opened, but why does the murderer not close it in order to make it conform with the appearance of the window in the other two rooms? I had to think about this. Poirot was right. The bodies had been laid out in this way deliberately. The killer must have wanted them to all look the same. Laying out the dead. I suppose it depends where you choose to draw your frame around the scene of the crime, I said hurriedly, as my mind tried to drag me back to my childhood's darkest room. Depends whether you want to extend it as far as the window. Frame? Yes, not a real frame, a theoretical one. Perhaps our murderer's frame for his creations was no larger than a square like this. I walked around Richard Negus's body, turning corners when necessary. You see, I've just walked a small frame around Negus, and the window is outside the frame. Poirot was smiling and trying to hide it beneath his moustaches. A theoretical frame around the murder. Yes, I see. Where does the scene of a crime begin, and where does it end? Well, this is the question. Can it be smaller than the room that contains it? This is a fascinating matter for the philosophers. Thank you. Pas du tout, Catchpool. Will you please tell me what you believe happened here at the Bloxham Hotel yesterday evening? Let us leave motive to one side for the moment. Tell me what you think the killer did, first and next and so on. I have no idea. Try to have an idea, Catchpool. Well, I suppose he came to the hotel, cufflinks in pocket, and went to each of the three rooms in turn. He probably started where we did, with Ida Gransbury in room 317, and worked his way down so that he would be able to leave the hotel fairly quickly after killing his final victim, Harriet Sipple, in room 121, on the first floor. Only one floor down, and he can escape. And what does he do in the three rooms? I sighed. You know the answer to that. He commits a murder and arranges the body in a straight line. He places a cufflink in the person's mouth, then he closes and locks the door and leaves. And to each room? He is admitted without question? In each room he finds his victim waiting with a most convenient drink for him to drop his poison into? Drinks that were delivered by hotel staff at precisely 7:15? He stands beside his victim, watching as the drink is consumed. And then he stands for a little longer as he waits for each one to die. And he stops to eat supper with one of them, Ida Gransbury, who has ordered a cup of tea for him too. All these visits to rooms, all these murders and putting of cufflinks in mouths and very formal arranging of bodies in straight lines with feet pointing towards the door, he is able to do between 7:15 and 8:10. This seems most unlikely, my friend, most unlikely indeed. Yes, it does. Have you got any better ideas, Poirot? And that's why you're here, to have better ideas than mine. Do please start any time you wish. I was regretting my outburst by the time I'd finished the sentence. I started long ago, said Poirot, who thankfully had not taken umbrage. You said that the killer left a note on the front desk informing of his crimes. Show it to me. I took it out of my pocket and passed it across to him. John Good, Lazzari's idea of perfection in the form of a hotel clerk, had found it on the front desk 10 minutes after 8:00. It read, May they never rest in peace, 121-238-317. So the murderer, or an accomplice of the murderer, was brazen enough to approach the desk, the main desk in the lobby of the hotel, with a note that would incriminate him if anyone saw him leaving it, said Poirot. He is audacious, confident. He did not disappear into the shadows using the back door.
After Lazzari read the note, he checked the three rooms and found the bodies, I said. Then he checked all the other rooms in the hotel. He was very proud to tell me. Fortunately, no other dead guests were found. I knew I oughtn't to say vulgar things, but it made me feel better somehow. If Poirot had been English, I probably would have made a greater effort to keep myself in check.
And did it occur to Monsieur Lazzari that one of his still-living guests might be a murderer?
No,
it did not. Any person who chooses to stay at the Bloxham Hotel must have a character of the utmost virtue and integrity.
I coughed and inclined my head towards the door. Poirot turned. Lazzari had let himself into the room and was standing in the doorway. He could hardly have looked happier.
So true, Monsieur Poirot, he said. Every single person who was in this hotel on Thursday must speak to Mr. Catchpole and account for their movements, Poirot told him sternly. Every guest, everyone who was here to work, all of them.
With the greatest pleasure, you may speak to whomsoever you wish, Mr. Catchpole.
Lazzari bowed in deference.
And our dining room will soon be at your disposal once we have cleared away the breakfast, paraphernalia, and gathered everybody together.
Merci. Meanwhile, I will conduct a thorough examination of the three rooms, said Poirot. This came as a surprise to me. I thought that was what we had just done. Catchpole, find out the addresses of Harriet Sipple, Ida Gronsberry and Richard Negus. Find out who in the hotel took their reservations, what food and drinks they each requested to be delivered to their rooms, and when, and from whom. I started to edge towards the door, fearing that Poirot would never stop dreaming up more tasks to add to the list. He called after me.
Find out if anyone by the name of Jenny is staying in the hotel or working here.
There is not a Jenny employed at the Bloxham, Monsieur Poirot,
said Lazzari.
Instead of asking Mr. Catchpole, you should ask me. Everybody here is well known to me. We are a very large, happy family here at the Bloxham Hotel.
Chapter 4 The Frame Widens.
Sometimes, remembering something a person said months or even years ago still makes you chuckle. And this, for me, is true of what Poirot said to me at some point later on that day.
It is hard for even the most ingenious detective to know what to do if his desire is to be free of Signor Lazzari. If one's praise of his hotel is insufficient, he stays by one's side and supplements it with his own. If one's praise is fulsome and lengthy, he stays to listen.
Poirot's efforts were eventually successful, and he finally managed to persuade Lazzari to leave him to his own devices in room 238. He walked over to the door that the hotel manager had left open, closed it, and sighed with relief. How much easier it was to think clearly when there was no babble of voices. He made straight for the window. An open window, he thought, as he stared out of it. The murderer might have opened it to escape after killing Richard Negus. He could have climbed down a tree. Why escape thus? Why not simply leave the room in the expected way, using the corridor? Perhaps the killer heard voices outside Negus's room and did not want to risk being seen. Yes, that was a possibility. And yet, when he strolled up to the front desk to leave his note announcing his three murders, he risked being seen. More than seen, he risked being caught in the act of leaving incriminating evidence. Poirot looked down at the body on the floor. No gleam of metal between the lips. Richard Negus, alone of the three victims, had the cufflink right at the back of his mouth. It was an anomaly. Too many things about this room were anomalous. For this reason, Poirot decided he would search room 238 first. He was... yes, there was no virtue in denying it. He was suspicious of this room. Of the three, it was his least favourite. There was something disorganised about it, something a little unruly. Poirot stood beside Negus's body and frowned. Even by his exacting standards, one open window was not enough to render a room chaotic. So what was it that was giving him this impression? He looked around, turning in a slow circle. No, he must be mistaken. Hercule Poirot was not often wrong, but it did happen very occasionally, and this must be one such instance, because 238 was an undeniably tidy room. There was no mess or muddle. It was as tidy as Harriet Sipple's room and Ida Gransbury's. "I shall shut the window and see if that makes a difference," said Poirot to himself. He did so, and surveyed the territory anew. Something was still not right. He did not like room 238. He would not have felt comfortable if he had arrived at the Bloxham Hotel and been shown to this. Suddenly the problem leapt out at him, putting an abrupt end to his meditations. The fireplace. One of the tiles was not aligned correctly. It was not straight. It jutted out. A loose tile. Poirot could not sleep in a room with such a thing. He eyed the body of Richard Negus. "If I were in the condition that you are in, oui, but not otherwise," he said to it. His only thought as he bent to touch the tile was that he might straighten it and push it back in so that it was flush with the others, to spare future guests the torment of knowing that there was something amiss in the room and being unable to work out what it was. What a service that would be, and to Signor Lazari also. When Poirot touched it, the tile fell clean out, and something else fell with it. A key with a number on it, 238. "Sacré tonnerre," Poirot whispered. "So the thorough search was not so thorough after all." Poirot replaced the key where he had found it, then set about inspecting the rest of the room, inch by inch. He discovered nothing else of interest, so he proceeded to room 317 and then to room 121, which was where I found him when I returned from my errands with exciting news of my own. Poirot being Poirot, he insisted on telling me his news first about his finding of the key. "All I can say is, in Belgium it is evidently not considered unseemly to gloat." He was quite puffed up with pride.
"Do you see what this means, mon ami? The open window was not opened by Richard Negus. It was opened after his death, having locked the door of room 238 from the inside. The murderer needed to escape. He did so, using the tree outside Mr. Negus's window, after he had hidden the key behind a tile in the fireplace that had come loose. He perhaps loosened it himself."
"Why not conceal it in his clothing, take it with him and leave the room in the customary way?" I asked.
"That is a question I have been asking myself. One that, for now, I am unable to answer," Poirot said. "I have satisfied myself there is no hidden key in this room, 121. Nor is there a key anywhere in room 317. The killer must have taken two keys with him when he left the Bloxham Hotel, so why not the third? Why is the treatment of Richard Negus different?"
"I hadn't the faintest idea," I said.
"Listen, I've been talking to John Good, the clerk..."
"The most dependable clerk," Poirot amended with a twinkle in his eye. "Yes, well... dependable or not, he's certainly come up trumps for us on the information front. You were right.
The three victims are connected. I've seen their addresses. Harriet Sipple and Ida Gransbury both lived in a place called Great Holling in the Culver Valley. Bon. And Richard Negus? No, he lived in Devon, a place called Beeworthy. But he's connected too. He booked all three hotel rooms, Ida's, Harriet's, and his own, and he paid for them ahead of time.
Did he indeed? This I find very interesting, Poirot murmured, stroking his moustaches.
Bit puzzling, if you ask me, I said. The main puzzle being, why, if they were coming from the same village on the same day, did Harriet Sipple and Ida Gransbury not travel together? Why did they not arrive together? I went over it several times with John Good, and he is adamant. Harriet arrived 2 hours before Ida on Wednesday, 2 full hours.
And the Richard Negus?
I resolved henceforth to include all details relating to Negus at the earliest opportunity, if only so that I wouldn't have to hear Poirot say, "And Richard Negus?" over and over again. He turned up an hour before Harriet Sipple. He was the first of the three to arrive, but it wasn't John Good who dealt with him. It was a junior clerk, a Mr. Thomas Brignall. I also found out that all three of our murder victims travelled to London by train, not car. I'm not sure if you wanted to know that, but...
I must know everything, said Poirot.
His obvious desire to be in charge and make the investigation his own both irritated and reassured me. The Bloxham has some cars that it sends out to fetch guests from the station, I told him. It's not cheap, but they're happy to sort it out for you. 3 weeks ago, Richard Negus made arrangements with John Good for the hotel's cars to meet him, Harriet Sipple, and Ida Gransbury. Separately, a car each. All of it, the rooms, the cars, it was all paid for in advance, by Negus.
I wonder if he was a wealthy man, Poirot mused aloud. So often, murder turns out to be about money.
What are your thoughts, Catchpole, now that we know a little more?
Well, I decided to throw myself into it since he'd asked. Imagining what was possible was a good thing in Poirot's book, so I would allow myself to concoct a theory using the facts as a starting point. Richard Negus must have known about all three arrivals, since he reserved and paid for the rooms. But perhaps Harriet Sipple didn't know that Ida Gransbury was also coming to the Bloxham, and perhaps Ida didn't know that Harriet was.
Oui, c'est possible.
Encouraged, I went on. Maybe it was essential to the murderer's plans that neither Ida nor Harriet should know about the presence of the other one. But if that's so, and if Richard Negus, meanwhile, knew that he and both women would be guests at the Bloxham... My well of ideas ran dry at that point. Poirot took over.
Our trains of thought proceed along similar tracks, my friend. Was Richard Negus an unwitting accomplice in his own murder? Perhaps the killer persuaded him to entice the victims to the Bloxham Hotel, supposedly for another reason, when all along he planned to murder all three of them. The question is this. Was it vital for some reason that Ida and Harriet should each be ignorant of the presence of the other in the hotel? And if so, was it important to Richard Negus, to the murderer, or to both?
Perhaps Richard Negus had one plan and the murderer had another.
Quite so, said Poirot. The next thing is to find out all that we can about Harriet Sipple, Richard Negus, and Ida Gransbury. Who were they when they were alive? What were their hopes, their grievances, their secrets?
The village, Great Holling. This is where we will look for our answers.
Perhaps we will also find Jenny there. And P.I.J.
Le Mystérieux.
There's no guest called Jenny. Now or last night, I checked.
I did not think that there would be. Fee Spring, the waitress, told me that Jenny lives in a house across town from Pleasant's Coffee House. That means in London, not Devon, and not the Culver Valley. Jenny has no need of a room at the Bloxham Hotel when she lives only across town.
Speaking of which,
Henry Negus, Richard's brother, is on his way here from Devon. Richard Negus lived with Henry and his family, and I've got some of my best men lined up to interview all the hotel guests.
You have been very efficient, Catchpole. Poirot patted my arm.
I felt obliged to advise Poirot of my one failure. This business with the dinners in the rooms is proving difficult to pin down, I said. I can't find anyone who was personally involved in taking the orders or making the deliveries. There seems to be some confusion.
Do not worry, said Poirot. I will do the necessary pinning when we gather in the dining room. In the meantime, let us take a walk around the hotel gardens. Sometimes a gentle perambulation causes a new idea to rise to the surface of one's thoughts.
As soon as we got outside, Poirot started to complain about the weather, which did seem to have taken a turn for the worse.
Shall we go back inside? I suggested.
No, not yet. The change of environment is good for the little grey cells, and perhaps the trees will afford some shelter from the wind. I do not mind the cold, but there is the good kind and the bad kind, and this today is the bad kind.
We stopped as we came to the entrance to the Bloxhams' gardens. Luca Lazzari had not exaggerated their beauty, I thought, as I stared at rows of pleached limes and, at the furthest end, the most artful topiary I had ever seen in London. This was nature not merely tamed, but forced into stunning submission. Even in a biting wind, it was exceptionally pleasing to the eye.
Well, I asked Poirot, are we going in or not?
It would be satisfying, I thought, to stroll up and down the green pathways between the trees, which were Roman roads straight.
I do not know. Poirot frowned. This weather, he shivered,
will extend unavoidably to the gardens. I completed his sentence somewhat impatiently. There are only two places we can be, Poirot, inside the hotel or outside it. Which do you prefer?
I have a better idea, he announced triumphantly. We will catch a bus.
A bus? To where?
To nowhere. Or somewhere. It does not matter. We will soon get off the bus and return on a different one. It will give us the change of scenery without the cold. Come, we will look out of the windows at the city. Who knows what we might observe?
He set off determinedly. I followed, shaking my head.
You're thinking of Jenny, aren't you? I said. It's extremely unlikely that we will see her. It is more likely than if we stand here looking at twigs and grass, said Poirot fiercely.
10 minutes later, we found ourselves trundling along on a bus with windows so fogged up that it was impossible to see anything through them. Wiping them with a handkerchief didn't help. I tried to talk some sense into Poirot.
About Jenny, I began.
Oui?
She might well be in danger, but really she's nothing to do with this business at the Bloxham. There's no evidence of a connection between the two, none at all.
I disagree, my friend, said Poirot sorrowfully. I am more than ever convinced of a connection.
You are?
Dash it all, Poirot, why?
Because of the two most unusual features that the situations have in common.
And what are those?
They will come to you, Catchpole.
Really, they cannot fail to strike you if you open your mind and think about what you know.
In the seats behind us, an elderly mother and her middle-aged daughter were discussing what made the difference between pastry that was merely good and pastry that was excellent.
Do you hear that, Catchpole? Whispered Poirot. La différence. Let us focus not on similarities, but on differences. This is what will point us towards our murderer.
What sort of differences? I asked.
Between two of the murders at the hotel and the third. What are the circumstantial details so different in the case of Richard Negus?
Why did the killer lock the door from the inside of the room instead of from the outside?
Why did he hide the key behind a loose tile in the fireplace instead of taking it with him? Why did he leave by the window, with the help of a tree, instead of by walking along the corridor in the normal way? At first, I wondered if perhaps he heard voices in the corridor and did not want to risk being seen leaving Mr. Negus's room. That seemed reasonable, I said. No, I do not, after all, think that was the reason. No, why not? Because of the positioning of the cufflink in Richard Negus's mouth, which was also different in this one case. Fully inside the mouth, near the throat, instead of between the lips. I groaned. Not this again, I really don't think. Ah! Wait! Catch pull! Let us see. The bus had stopped. Poirot craned his neck to inspect the new passengers who boarded, and sighed when the last one, a slender man in a tweed suit with more hair growing from his ears than on his head, was in. You're disappointed because none of them is Jenny, I said. I needed to say it aloud in order to believe it, I think. Non, mon ami. You are correct about the sentiment, but not about its cause. I feel the disappointment every time I think that, in a city as enormous as London, I am unlikely ever to see Jenny again. And yet, I hope. For all your talk of scientific method, you're a bit of a dreamer, aren't you? You believe hope to be the enemy of science and not its driving force. If so, I disagree, just as I disagree with you about the cufflink. It is a significant difference in the case of Richard Negus from the other two, the women. The difference of the position of the cufflink in Mr. Negus's mouth cannot be explained by the killer hearing the voices of people in the corridor and wanting to avoid them. Poirot spoke over me. Therefore, there must be another explanation. Until we know what it is, we cannot be certain that it does not also apply to the open window, the key hidden in the room, and the door locked from the inside. There comes a point in most cases, and by no means only those in which Hercule Poirot has involved himself, when one starts to feel that it would be a greater comfort, and actually no less effective, to talk only to oneself, and dispense with all attempts to communicate with the outside world. In my head, to a sensible and appreciative audience of one, I silently made the following point. The cufflink being in a slightly different part of Richard Negus's mouth was of absolutely no consequence. A mouth is a mouth, and that was all there was to it. In the murderer's mind, he had done the same thing to each of his three victims. He had opened their mouths and placed a monogrammed gold cufflink inside each one. I could not think of any explanation for the hiding of the key behind the loose fireplace tile. It would have been quicker and easier for the murderer to take it with him, or drop it on the carpet after wiping it clean of his fingerprints. Behind us, the mother and daughter had exhausted the topic of pastry and moved on to suet. "We ought to think about returning to the hotel," said Poirot. "But we've only just got on the bus," I protested. "Oui, c'est vrai. But we do not want to stray too far from the Bloxham. We will soon be needed in the dining room." I exhaled slowly, knowing it would be pointless to ask why, in that case, he had felt it necessary to leave the hotel in the first place. "We must get off this bus and catch another," he said. "Perhaps there will be better views from the next one." There were. Poirot saw no sign of Jenny, much to his consternation, but I saw some amusing sights that made me realize all over again why I loved London. A man dressed in a clown costume, juggling about as badly as I had ever seen a person juggle. Still, passers-by were throwing coins into the hat by his feet. Other highlights were a poodle that had a face exactly like a prominent politician, and a vagrant sitting on the pavement with an open suitcase behind him, eating food out of it, as if it were his very own mobile tuck shop. "Look, Poirot," I said. "That chap doesn't care about the cold. He's as happy as the cat that got the cream. The tramp that got the cream, I should say. Poirot, look at that poodle. Does it remind you of anyone? Somebody famous? Go on, look. You can't fail to see it." "Catch pool," Poirot said severely.
Stand up, or we will miss our stop. Always you look away, seeking the diversion.
I rose to my feet. As soon as we were off the bus, I said, "You're the one who took me on a pointless sightseeing tour of London. You can hardly blame me for taking an interest in the sights." Poirot stopped walking.
"Tell me something. Why will you not look at the three bodies in the hotel? What is it that you cannot bear to observe?"
"Nothing. I've looked at the bodies as much as you have. I did quite a lot of looking before you turned up, as a matter of fact."
"If you do not wish to discuss it with me, you only need to say so, mon ami."
"There is nothing to discuss. I don't know anybody who would stare at a deceased person for any longer than necessary. That's all there is to it."
"No," said Poirot quietly. "It is not all.
I dare say I ought to have told him, and I still don't know why I didn't. My grandfather died when I was 5. He was dying for a long time, in a room in our house. I didn't like going to visit him in his room every day, but my parents insisted that it was important to him, and so I did it to please them, and for his sake also. I watched his skin turn gradually yellower, and listened as his breathing became more shallow and his eyes less focused. I didn't think of it then as fear, but I remember, every day, counting the seconds that I had to spend in that room, knowing that eventually I would be able to leave, close the door behind me, and stop counting. When he died, I felt as if I had been released from prison and could be fully alive again. He would be taken away, and there would be no more death in the house. And then my mother told me that I must go and see Grandfather one last time, in his room. She would come with me, she said. It would be all right. The doctor had laid him out. My mother explained to me about the laying out of the dead. I counted the seconds in silence. More seconds than usual. 130 at least, standing by my mother's side, looking at Grandpa's still, shrunken body. "Hold his hand, Edward," my mother said. When I said I didn't want to, she started to weep as if she would never stop. So I held Grandpa's dead, bony hand. I wanted more than anything to drop it and run away, but I clung to it until my mother stopped crying and said we could go back downstairs. "Hold his hand, Edward. Hold his hand."
Chapter 5. Ask 100 People. I barely noticed the large crowd gathered in the Bloxham Hotel's dining room as Poirot and I walked in. The room itself was so striking that I couldn't help but be diverted by its grandeur. I stopped in the doorway and stared up at the high, lavishly ornamented ceiling with its many emblems and carvings. It was strange to think of people eating ordinary things like toast and marmalade at the tables below a work of art such as this, not even looking up, perhaps, as they sliced the top off their boiled eggs. I was trying to make sense of the complete design and how the different parts of the ceiling related to one another, when a disconsolate Luca Lazzari rushed towards me, interrupting my admiration of the artistic symmetry above my head, with his loud lament.
"Mr. Catchpole, Monsieur Poirot, I must apologize to your mouth profusely. I have hurried to assist you in your important work, and in doing so, I have put forward a falsehood. It was simply, you see, that I heard many accounts, and my first attempt to collate them was not successful. My own foolishness was responsible. No one else was at fault.
Lazzari broke off and looked over his shoulder at the 100 or so men and women in the room. Then he moved to his left, so that he was standing directly in front of Poirot, and stuck out his chest in a funny sort of way. He put his hands on his hips. I think he was hoping to hide his entire staff from Poirot's disapproving eye, on the principle that if they couldn't be seen, they couldn't be blamed for anything.
"What was your mistake, Signor Lazzari?" Poirot asked. "It was a grave error. You observed that it was surely not possible, and you were right. But I want you to understand that my excellent staff, who you see here before you, told me the truth of what took place, and it was I who twisted that truth to mislead, but I did not do it deliberately. Je comprends. Now, to correct the mistake?
Said Poirot, hopefully. The excellent staff, meanwhile, sat silently at large round tables, listening carefully to every word. The mood was sombre. I made a quick survey of the faces and saw not a single smile.
I told you that the three deceased guests asked to have dinner served in their rooms at 7:15 yesterday evening, each separately,
Lazare said.
This is not true. The three were together. They dined as a group. All in one room. Ida Gransberry's room number 317. One waiter, not three, saw them alive and well at 7:15. Do you see, Monsieur Poirot, it is not the great coincidence that I conveyed to you, but instead a commonplace occurrence, three guests taking dinner together in the room of one.
Bon. Poirot sounded satisfied. That makes sense of that. And who was this one waiter? A stout, bald man, seated at one of the tables, rose to his feet. He looked to be around 50, and had the jowlish tendency and mournful eyes of a basset hound.
It was I, sir, he said.
What is your name, monsieur?
Raphael Bobac, sir.
You served dinner to Harriet Sipple, Ida Gransberry, and Richard Negus in room 317 at 7:15 yesterday evening?
Poirot asked him.
Not a dinner, sir, said Bobac. Afternoon tea, that was what Mr. Negus ordered. Afternoon tea at dinner time. He asked if that was all right, or if I was going to force them to have what he called a dinner sort of dinner. Told me that he and his friends were of one mind as not being in the mood for one of those. He said they'd rather have afternoon tea. I told him he could have whatever he wanted, sir. He asked for sandwiches, ham, cheese, salmon, and cucumber, and an assortment of cakes. And scones, sir, with jam and cream.
And beverages?
Poirot asked.
Tea, sir, for all three of them.
D'accord. And the sherry for Richard Negus?
Raphael Bobac shook his head.
No, sir, no sherry. Mr. Negus didn't ask me for a sherry. I didn't take a glass of sherry up to room 317.
You are certain of this?
Absolutely, sir.
Being on display in front of all those pairs of eyes was making me feel a touch awkward. I was painfully aware that I had not yet asked a question. Letting Poirot run the show was all very well, but if I didn't participate at all, I would look feeble. I cleared my throat and addressed the room.
Did any of you take a cup of tea to Harriet Sipple's room, number 121, at any point? Or a sherry to Richard Negus's room, either yesterday or Wednesday, the day before?
Heads began to shake. Unless someone was lying, it seemed that the only delivery to any of the three victims' rooms was the one of afternoon tea for dinner made by Raphael Bobac to room 317 at 7:15 p.m. on Thursday. I tried to sort it out in my mind. The teacup in Harriet Sipple's room wasn't a problem. That must have been one of the three brought by Bobac, since only two cups were found in Ida Gransbury's room after the murders. But how did the sherry glass make its way to Richard Negus's room, unless transported there by a waiter? Did the killer arrive at the Bloxham with a glass of Harvey's Bristol Cream in his hand, as well as a pocket full of monogrammed cufflinks and poison? It seemed far-fetched. Poirot appeared to have fixed on the same problem.
To be absolutely clear, not one of you gave a glass of sherry to Mr. Richard Negus, either in his room or anywhere else in the hotel.
There was more head-shaking.
Signor Lazari, can you tell me, please, was the glass found in Mr. Negus's room one that belonged to the Bloxham Hotel? Yes, it was, Monsieur Poirot. This is all very perplexing. I would suggest that perhaps a waiter who is absent today gave the glass of sherry to Mr. Negus on Thursday or Wednesday, but everybody is here now. Who was here then?
It is, as you say, perplexing, Poirot agreed.
Mr. Bobak, perhaps you could tell us what happened when you took the evening afternoon tea to Ida Gransberry's room.
Set it out on the table, and then I left them to it, sir. There were all three in the room, Mrs. Sippel, Miss Gransberry, and Mr. Negus. They were, yes, sir.
Describe to us the scene.
The scene, sir. Seeing that Raphael Bobak was at a loss, I chipped in with, which one of them opened the door?
Mr. Negus opened the door, sir.
And where were the two women? I asked.
Oh, they were sitting in the two chairs over by the fireplace, talking to each other. I had no dealings with them. I spoke only to Mr. Negus, laid everything out on the table by the window, and then I left, sir.
Can you recall what the two ladies talked about? Asked Poirot.
Bobak lowered his eyes.
Well, sir.
It is important, monsieur. Every detail that you can tell me about these three people is important.
Well, they were being a bit cattish, sir, laughing about it, too.
You mean they were being spiteful? How so?
One of them was, yes, and Mr. Negus, he seemed to find it entertaining. It was something about an older woman and a younger man. It wasn't my business, so I didn't listen.
Do you remember what precisely was said? At whom was the cattishness directed?
I couldn't tell you, sir. I'm sorry. An old woman that might be pining for the love of a young man, that was the sense I got. It sounded like gossip to me.
Monsieur, said Poirot in his most authoritative voice,
if you should happen to remember anything else about this conversation, anything at all, please inform me without delay.
I shall, sir.
Now that I think about it, the young man might have deserted the older woman and eloped with another woman. Idle gossip, that's all it was.
So,
Poirot started to pace the length of the room. It was strange to see more than 100 heads turn slowly, then turn back as he retraced his steps.
We have Richard Negus, Harriet Sippel, and Ida Gransberry. One man and two women in room 317, talking cattishly about one man and two women.
But what's the significance of that, Poirot? I asked.
It might not be significant. It is interesting, however. And the idle gossip, the laughter, the afternoon tea for dinner. This tells us that our three murder victims were not strangers, but acquaintances on friendly terms, unaware of the fate that would shortly befall them.
A sudden movement startled me. At the table, immediately in front of where Poirot and I were standing, a black-haired, pale-faced young man had bounced out of his seat as if propelled from underneath. I would have assumed he was eager to say something, were it not for the terror-frozen expression on his face.
"This is one of our junior clerks, Mr. Thomas Brignell,"
said Lazari, presenting the man with a flourish of his hand.
"They were more than on friendly terms, sir."
Brignell breathed after a protracted silence. No one sitting behind him could have heard what he said, his voice was so quiet.
"They were good friends. They knew each other well."
"Of course they were good friends,"
Lazari announced to the room.
"They ate a meal together."
"Many people eat meals every day with those they dislike profoundly," said Poirot.
"Please continue, Mr. Brignell."
"When I met Mr. Negus last night, he was concerned for the two ladies as only a good friend would be,"
Thomas Brignell whispered at us.
"You met him?" I said. "When?
Where?
7:30, sir.
He pointed towards the dining room's double doors. I noticed that his arm was shaking.
Right outside here. I walked out and saw him going towards the lift. He saw me and stopped, called me over. I assumed he was making his way back to his room.
What did he say to you?
Poirot asked.
He asked me to make sure that the meal was charged to him and not to either of the ladies. He could afford it, he said, but Mrs. Sipple and Miss Gransbury could not.
Was that all he said, monsieur?
Yes.
Brignall looked as if he might faint if he was required to produce one more word. Thank you, Mr. Brignall, I said as warmly as I could. You've been very helpful. Immediately I felt guilty for not having thanked Raphael Bobak in a similar manner, so I added, As have you, Mr. Bobak. As have you all.
Catchpool, Poirot murmured.
Most people in this room have said nothing. They have listened attentively and applied their minds to the problems presented to them. I think they deserve credit for that.
You have faith in their minds, yes?
Perhaps these are the 100 people you call upon when we disagree.
Bien. If we were to ask these 100 people...
Poirot turned back to the crowd. Ladies and gentlemen, we have heard that Richard Negus, Harriet Sipple, and Ida Gransbury were friends, and that their food was delivered to room 317 at 7:15. Yet at 7:30, Mr. Brignall saw Richard Negus on this floor of the hotel, walking towards the lift. Mr. Negus must have been returning, n'est-ce pas, either to his own room, 238, or to room 317 to join his two friends.
But returning from where?
His sandwiches and cake were delivered only 15 minutes earlier.
Did he abandon them immediately and set off somewhere?
Or did he eat his share of the food in only 3 or 4 minutes before rushing off?
And to where did he rush?
What was the important errand for which he left room 317? Was it to ensure that the food should not end up on the bill of Harriet Sipple or Ida Gransbury? He could not wait 20 or 30 minutes or an hour before setting off to attend to this matter?
A sturdily built woman with curly brown hair and severe eyebrows sprang to her feet at the back of the room.
You keep asking all these questions as if I might know the answer, as if we all might know the answers, and we don't know nothing.
Her eyes darted around the room as she spoke, settling on one person after another, though her words were addressed to Poirot.
I want to go home, Mr. Lazari, she wailed. I want to look in on my kiddies and see that they're safe.
A younger woman sitting beside her put a hand on her arm and tried to calm her.
Sit down, Tessie, she said.
The gentleman's only trying to help. Your bairns won't have come to any harm, not if they've been nowhere near the Bloxham.
At this remark, intended as a comfort, both Luca Lazari and sturdy Tessie made anguished noises.
"We won't keep you much longer, madam," I said. "And I'm sure Mr. Lazari will allow you to pay a visit to your children afterwards, if that is what you feel you need to do." Lazari indicated that this would be permissible, and Tessie sat down, slightly mollified. I turned to Poirot and said, "Richard Negus did not leave room 317 in order to clear up the matter of the bill. He ran into Thomas Brignall on his way back from somewhere, so he had already done whatever it was that he set out to do by that point. He then happened to spot Mr. Brignall and decided to clear up the matter of the bill." I hoped with this little speech to demonstrate to all present that we had answers as well as questions. Perhaps not all the answers yet, but some, and some was better than none.
Monsieur Brignall, did you have the impression that Mr. Negus happened to see you and take his opportunity, as Mr. Catchpool describes? He was not looking for you. It was you who attended to him when he arrived at the hotel on Wednesday, yes?
That's right, sir. No, he wasn't looking for me.
Brignall seemed happier about speaking while seated.
He chanced upon me and thought, oh, there's that chap again, if you know what I mean, sir.
Indeed. Ladies and gentlemen,
Poirot raised his voice.
After committing 3 murders in this hotel yesterday evening, the killer, or somebody who knows the identity of the killer, and conspired with him, left a note on the front desk. May they never rest in peace. 121-238-317. Did anybody happen to observe the leaving of this note that I show to you now?
Poirot produced the small white card from his pocket and held it up in the air.
It was found by the clerk, Mr. John Good, at 8:10. Did any of you, perhaps, notice a person or persons near the desk who seemed to be conducting themselves in an unusual way? Think hard. Somebody must have seen something.
Stout Tessie had screwed her eyes shut and was leaning against her friend. The room had filled with whispers and gasps, but it was only the shock and excitement of seeing the handwriting of a killer, a souvenir that made the 3 deaths seem more vividly real. Nobody had anything more to tell us. It turned out that if you asked 100 people, you were likely to be disappointed. Chapter 6 The Sherry Conundrum. Half an hour later, Poirot and I sat drinking coffee in front of a roaring fire in what Lazzari had called our hidden lounge, a room that was behind the dining room and not accessible from any public corridor. The walls were covered with portraits, which I tried to ignore. Give me a sunny landscape any day of the week, or even a cloudy one. It's the eyes that bother me when people are depicted. It doesn't seem to matter who the artist is. I've yet to see a portrait and not be convinced that its subject is regarding me with searing scorn. After his exuberant performance as master of ceremonies in the dining room, Poirot had lapsed once more into quiet gloom. "You're fretting about Jenny again, aren't you?" I asked him. He admitted that he was. "I do not want to hear that she has been found with a cufflink in her mouth with the monogram P.I.J. That is the news I dread." "Since there is nothing you can do about Jenny for the time being, I suggest you think about something else," I advised. "How practical you are, Catchpool." "Very well. Let us think about teacups." "Teacups?"
"Yes. What do you make of them?"
After some consideration, I said, "I believe I have no opinions whatever on the subject of teacups."
Poirot made an impatient noise. 3 teacups are brought to Ida Gransberry's room by the waiter Raphael Bobek. 3 teacups for 3 people, as one would expect. But when the bodies of the 3 are found, there are only 2 teacups in the room.
The other one is in Harriet Sipple's room with Harriet Sipple's dead body," I said.
"Exactement. And this is most curious, is it not? Did Mrs. Sipple carry her teacup and saucer back to her room before or after the poison was put into it? In either scenario, who would carry a cup of tea along a hotel corridor and then take it into a lift or walk down 2 flights of stairs with it in their hands? Either it is full and there is a risk of spillage, or it is half full or almost empty and hardly worth transporting. Usually one drinks a cup of tea in the room in which one pours the cup of tea, n'est-ce pas?"
"Usually, yes. This killer strikes me as being as far from usual as it's possible to be," I said with some vehemence.
"And his victims? Are they not ordinary people? What about their behavior? Do you ask me to believe that Harriet Sipple carries her tea down to her room, sits in a chair to drink it, and then almost immediately the murderer knocks on her door, finds an opportunity to put a cyanide in her drink?
And Richard Negus, remember, has also left Ida Gronsberry's room for some unknown reason, but he arranges to be back in his own room soon afterwards with a glass of sherry that nobody at the hotel gave him.
I suppose when you put it like that, I said. Poirot carried on as if I had not just conceded the point.
Ah, yes, Richard Negus, too. He is sitting alone with his drink when the killer pays him a visit.
He, too, says, by all means, drop your poison into my sherry. And Ida Gronsberry, she is all the while waiting patiently in room 317, alone, for the murderer to come calling. She sips her tea very slowly. It would be inconsiderate of her to finish it before the killer arrives. Of course, how then would he poison her? Where would he put his cyanide? Damn it, Poirot, what do you want me to say? I don't understand it any more than you do. Look, it seems to me that the three murder victims must have had some kind of altercation. Why else would they plan to dine together and then all go their separate ways? I do not think a woman leaving a room in anger would take a half-finished cup of tea with her, said Poirot. Would it not in any case be cold by the time it reached room 121? I often drink tea cold, I said. I quite like it. Poirot raised his eyebrows. If I did not know you to be an honest man, I should not believe it. Cold tea. Degulas. Well, I should say I've grown to like it, I added in my defence. There's no hurry with cold tea. You can drink it at a time to suit you. And nothing bad's going to happen to it if you take a while. There's no time constraint and no pressure. That counts for a lot in my book. There was a knock at the door. That will be Lazari coming to check that no one has disturbed us during our important conversation, I said.
Enter, please,
Poirot called out. It was not Luca Lazari, but Thomas Brignall, the junior clerk who had spoken up about having seen Richard Negus by the lift at 7:30.
Ah, Monsieur Brignall, said Poirot. Do join us. Your account of yesterday evening was most helpful. Mr. Catchpool and I are grateful.
Yes, very much so, I said heartily. I'd have said almost anything to make it easier for Brignall to cough up whatever was bothering him. It was obvious that something was. The poor chap looked no more confident now than he had in the dining room. He rubbed the palms of his hands together, sliding them up and down. I could see sweat on his forehead, and he looked paler than he had before.
"I've let you down," he said. "I've let Mr. Lazari down, and he's been so good to me, yes? I didn't... in the dining room before, I didn't..."
He broke off and rubbed his palms together some more.
"You did not tell us the truth?" Poirot suggested.
"Every word I spoke was the truth, sir," said Thomas Brignall indignantly. "I'd be no better than the murderer myself if I lied to the police on a matter as important as this."
"I do not think you would be quite as guilty as him, monsieur."
There were two things I neglected to mention. I can't tell you how sorry I am, sir. You see, speaking in front of a room full of people isn't something as comes easy to me. I've always been that way. And what made it harder in there, before..."
He nodded in the direction of the dining room.
"Was that I'd have been reluctant to say the other thing Mr. Negus said to me, because he paid me a compliment."
"What compliment?"
"It wasn't one that I've done anything to deserve, sir, I'm sure. I'm just an ordinary man. There's nothing notable about me at all. I do my job, as I'm paid to, and I try to do my best, but there's no reason for anyone to single me out for special praise."
"And Mr. Negus did this?"
asked Poirot.
"He singled you out for praise?"
Brignall winced.
"Yes, sir. Like I said, I didn't ask for it, and I'm sure I'd done nothing to earn it. But when I saw him and he saw me, he said, 'Ah, Mr. Brignall, you seem a most efficient fellow. I know I can trust you with this.'" Then he proceeded to discuss the matter I mentioned before, sir, about the bill and him wanting to pay it.
And you did not want to repeat the compliment you had received in front of everybody else, is that right?
I said.
You feared it might sound boastful.
Yes, I did, sir. I did indeed. There's something else, too. Once we'd agreed the matter of the bill, Mr. Negus asked me to fetch him a sherry. I was the person that did that. I offered to take it up to his room, but he said he was happy to wait. I brought it to him, and then up he went with it in the lift.
Poirot sat forward in his chair.
Yet you said nothing when I asked if anyone in the room had given Richard Negus a glass of sherry?
Brignall looked confused and frustrated, as if the right answer was on the tip of his tongue, but still somehow eluded him.
I ought to have done, sir. I ought to have offered a full account of the incident as soon as you asked. I deeply regret that I failed in my duty to you and to the three deceased guests, God rest their souls. I can only hope that by coming to you now I've made a small amends.
Indeed, indeed. But, monsieur, I am curious about why you did not speak up in the dining room. When I asked, who here took Richard Negus a glass of sherry? What was it that caused you to remain silent?
The poor clerk had started to tremble.
I swear on my dear late mother's grave, Mr. Poirot, I've now told you every particular of my encounter with Mr. Negus yesterday evening, every last particular. You couldn't have a more complete knowledge of what transpired. Of that you may rest assured.
Poirot opened his mouth to ask another question, but I leapt in before him and said, "Thank you very much, Mr. Brignall. Please don't worry about not having told us sooner. I understand how hard it is to stand up and speak in front of a crowd. I don't much like it myself." Once dismissed, Brignall hurried to the door like a fox fleeing from hounds. "I believe him," I said when he had gone. "He's told us everything he knows."
"About his meeting with Richard Negus beside the hotel lift?"
"Yes. The detail he conceals relates to himself."
"Why did he not speak up in the dining room about the sherry?" I asked him that question twice, and still he did not answer. Instead, he elaborated upon his remorse, which was sincere. He would not lie, but he cannot bring himself to speak the truth.
Ah, how he withholds! It is a form of lying, a very effective one, for there is no spoken lie to be contested.
Poirot chuckled suddenly.
"And you, Catchpool,
you seek to protect him from Hercule Poirot, who would press him again and again, eh, for the information?"
He looked as if he'd reached his limit, and frankly, if he is keeping quiet about anything, it's something that he thinks is of no consequence to us, and yet it's a cause of great embarrassment to him. He's a fretful, conscientious sort. His sense of duty would oblige him to tell us if he thought it mattered.
"And because you sent him away, I did not have the chance to explain to him that the information he withholds might be vital."
Having raised his voice, Poirot glared at me to make sure I noted his annoyance.
"Even I, Hercule Poirot, do not yet know what matters and what is irrelevant. That is why I must know everything."
He stood up.
"And now I will return to Pleasance," he said abruptly. "The coffee there is far better than Signor Lazari's."
"But Richard Negus's brother Henry is on his way," I protested. "I thought you would want to speak to him."
"I need a change of scenery, Catchpool. I must revitalize my little grey cells. They will begin to stagnate if I do not take them elsewhere."
"Poppycock. You're hoping to bump into Jenny, or hear news of her," I said. "Poirot, I do think you're on a desperate goose chase with this Jenny business. You know it too, or else you wouldn't admit you're going to Pleasance in the hope of finding her."
"Maybe so. But if there is a goose killer at large, what else is one to do? Bring Mr. Henry Negus to Pleasance. I will talk to him there."
"What? He's coming all the way from Devon. He's not going to want to arrive and then leave at once for..."
"But does he want the dead goose?"
Poirot demanded.
"Ask him that."
I resolved to ask Henry Negus no such thing,
for fear he might turn on his heel and go straight back to whence he came, having decided that Scotland Yard had been taken over by madmen. Chapter 7. Two Keys. Poirot arrived at the coffee house to find it very busy and smelling of a mixture of smoke and something sweet like pancake syrup.
"I need a table, but they are all taken,"
he complained to Fee Spring, who had only just arrived herself and was standing by the wooden coat stand with her coat draped over her arm. When she pulled off her hat, her flyaway hair crackled and hung in the air for a few seconds before succumbing to gravity. The effect was rather comical, thought Poirot.
"Your need's in trouble, then, isn't it?"
she said cheerfully.
"I can't shoo paying patrons out onto the street, not even for a famous detective."
She lowered her voice to a whisper.
"Mr. and Mrs. O'Cecil will be on their way before too long. You can sit where they're sat." "Mr. and Mrs. O'Cecil? That is an unusual name."
Fee laughed at him, then whispered again.
"O'Cecil. That's what she says all day long, the wife. The husband, poor soul, he can't get as much as two words out of his mouth without her setting him straight. He says he'd like scrambled eggs and toast. Right away she pipes up, 'Oh, Cecil, not eggs and toast.' And don't think he has to speak to set her off. He sits down at the first table he comes to, and she says, 'Oh, Cecil, not this table.' Of course, he ought to say he wants what he don't want, and don't want what he wants. That's what I do. I keep waiting for him to tumble to it, but he's a useless old lump, truth be told. Brain like a mouldy cabbage. I expect that's what started her O'Cecil-ing.
"If he does not leave soon, I shall say O'Cecil to him myself,"
said Poirot, whose legs were already aching from a combination of standing and the thwarted desire to be seated.
"They'll be gone before your coffee's ready,"
Fee said.
"She's finished her meal, see? She'll O'Cecil him out of here in no time. What are you doing here lunchtime, anyway?"
"Wait, I know what you're up to."
"Looking for Jenny, aren't you? I heard you were in first thing this morning, too."
"How did you hear it?" Poirot asked. "You have only just arrived, n'est-ce pas?
"I'm never far away,"
said Fee enigmatically.
"No one seed hide nor hair of Jenny. But you know, Mr. Poirot, I've got her stuck in my mind, same as she's stuck in yours."
"You too are worried."
"Not about her being in danger. It's not up to me to save her."
"No."
"Nor is it up to you."
"Ah, but Hercule Poirot, he has saved lives. He has saved innocent men from the gallows."
"A good half of them's probably guilty,"
said Fee cheerfully, as if the idea amused her.
"No, mademoiselle, vous êtes misanthrope."
"If you say so. All's I know is, if I worried about everyone as comes in here needing to be worried about, I'd not have a moment's peace. It's one sorry predicament after another, and most of it's coming from their own heads, not real problems."
"If something is in a person's head, then it is real," Poirot said.
"Not if it's daft nonsense dreamed up out of nowhere, which it often is," said Fee. "Now, what I meant about Jenny is, I noticed something last night, except I can't think what it might be. Now, I remember thinking, 'It's funny, Jenny doing that, or saying that.' Only trouble is, I can't remember what set me off thinking it, you know, what she did or what she said. I've tried and tried till it's made me head spin. Ah, look, they're going, Mr. and Mrs. O'Cecil. You go and sit yourself down. Coffee?"
"Yes, please. Mademoiselle, will you please continue in your efforts to remember what Jenny did or said? It matters more than I can express."
"More than straight shelves?"
Fee asked with sudden sharpness.
"More than cutlery laid out square on the table?"
"Ah, you think these things are the dreamed-up nonsense?" Poirot asked.
Fee's face reddened.
"Sorry if I spoke out of turn," she said. "It's only, well, you'd be a good deal happier, wouldn't you, if you stopped fussing about how a fork sits on a tablecloth?"
Poirot gave her the benefit of his best polite smile.
"I would be very much happier if you were to remember what it was about Mademoiselle Jenny that has stuck in your mind."
With that, he made a dignified exit from the conversation and sat down at his table. He waited for an hour and a half, during which time he ate a good lunch, but saw no sign of Jenny. It was nearly 2 o'clock when I arrived at Pleasance, with a man in tow whom Poirot at first took to be Henry Negus, Richard's brother. There was some confusion as I explained that I had left Constance